Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast Supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give and there's no regular commitment. Just hit the link in the show description to support now.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Finding your perfect home was hard, but thanks to Burrow, furnishing it has never been easier. Burrow's easy-to-assemble modular sofas and sectionals are made from premium, durable materials, including stain and scratch-resistant fabrics. So they're not just comfortable and stylish, they're built to last. Plus, every single Burrow order ships free right to your door. Right now, get 15% off your first order at burrow.com/ACAST. That's 15% off at burrow.com/ACAST.
Hello, and welcome to the Ask the Industry podcast, episode 83. For those of you new to the show, I'm comedian Simon Kane, and this is the podcast where I interview the most influential people from the worlds of stand-up comedy, radio, and today, the live circuit. Brendan Burns is an Australian stand-up comedian and author who is known for his boisterous stage presence and controversial material. We got talking about how he found his audience through podcasting and how he has continued to grow it through extensively touring new shows and giving away free content online. As regular listeners of the show will be aware, I'm a big fan of free content online, although I'm also a big fan of making the money back in other ways. So this for me was a very interesting interview and I got loads out of it, and I really enjoyed hearing his perspective on why he started doing that and why he started gigging in any venue that wasn't a comedy club, which sounds counterintuitive and counterproductive, but it's worked for him. And frankly, I found that as a process and that as a thing to do really interesting. There was a little moment quite late on in the episode where it got awkward. Only briefly, it got awkward. Very briefly. Basically, I said something that I'd been thinking about quite a lot in the run-up to the US election, which is when we recorded this, and he said something from a show that he did the previous year that I hadn't actually seen, and we got into quite a long debate and quite a detailed discussion about the nature of ownership of ideas in jokes and whether you can actually claim an ownership of an idea, as he jumped in quite quickly and said, "I've said that, I've done that in a joke." And for me, that was one of the most interesting parts of the discussion as well, because I think a lot of us do that. A lot of us say something like, "Oh, I've got a joke like that," because we get quite defensive about whether that's our idea. And I don't see that so much in music. Like, no one goes, "Oh, I've written a song about love." Like nobody sort of tries to own a certain subject like that. They try and just own the style of the way they perform it. Whereas with comedians, they go, "I've done a joke like that." And I've been in green rooms before where that's happened before, and no one's really sort of followed it up with a discussion about whether that's actually even possible. So for me, that was really interesting and quite nice to tackle head on. I had a lot of fun editing this, and I think you're going to get a lot out of it. Brendan is going to be doing the Edinburgh Fringe Festival 2017, as am I, which is next month if you've downloaded this in July when it came out. I'll plug the shows at the end of the podcast, but if you want that information before then, just have a look at the show notes or the website, which is simonkane.co.uk. If you are new here, please do hit subscribe. If you're old here, please do consider to give it a review in iTunes. But now, without any more delays, this is Brendan Burns.
Go on.
What?
I assume you want to say something about what's just happened.
You're the worst. You're the fucking worst. So, last time he didn't record, right? And then this time, he's come to me house, and I've got to go to work in whenever, and he's sat here dicking around with his new equipment that I had to show him how to fucking use. Bearing in mind, I'm 45. How old are you?
I'm younger than you.
And younger than me.
I'm 29. Oh,
you're 29?
Thanks for that. Yeah, I'm 29.
Okay, he's 29. I had to teach the millennial how to use technology. And he still managed to fuck it up.
But you used
it. I got it working, and then you touched it, and it fucked up.
But this is what you use.
I do, but I don't have these fucking mics that need to be powered by it. And I understand the program.
Oh, you're using
that I use to edit. I use GarageBand.
You're using GarageBand,
which is pretty basic. That's true. Yeah. But I was teaching him how to feed his Zoom recorder into, which I'm sorry, in my defense, my job here is done. I fucking got your Zoom recorder and I hooked it up to your Mac it detected it.
All right, yeah.
And then it was working and then it stopped working the moment you went, wait a minute, why don't I try and...
Why don't I play with the settings a bit more?
The worst. He's the fucking worst, ladies and gentlemen.
I'll tell you really quickly, right? So I get really annoyed by this because... Not just this.
Oh, really? Really? Is your patience tested? Go on.
The reason I get annoyed is because... I just want an episode of audio on the internet. I want the least number of complicated steps between what I'm doing and what the result needs to be.
But I'm with you on that.
And this software usually makes it easier than GarageBand.
Yeah.
Because I use GarageBand for about 7 months.
It's infuriating.
Yeah.
It loses files, doesn't autosave, all sorts of stuff.
But I wouldn't say from this experience that you should get this software.
That I should get Adobe. I'm not ready for Adobe, I think.
No, I think you're okay
having
with the
record. Said that, one of the reasons I discovered that you run into so many problems with GarageBand is it makes massive files.
Yes.
And if you don't delete them or get yourself a hard drive and work remotely on a hard drive, it will often... Rather than tell you, hey, you're out of memory, it just loses shit. And you can do an hour of audio of talking and an hour of editing. And then you go to drag and drop
and it loses it.
And then you go back to where it was and it's not there anymore. And you're like, what the fuck went on? It took me 6 months of screaming to work that out.
I would rather, so the first time round when we did this, I would rather lose the file before spending time editing than lose the time that I did editing.
Oh.
Because editing is the hard part.
Oh,
I had someone message me the other day because they're starting their own podcast, and I hope they do, but they were like, I don't know where I'm going to find an hour to do the recording every week. And I was like, that's not the time problem.
No.
The time problem
But the thing I've just taught you to do is going to save you...
Well... When I work out to get it to do two tracks rather than one.
But rather than taking it from the SD card back and forth, now that you can record directly into your laptop, it's going to be such a time saver.
Well,
the extent where you're going to go, what was I doing? You're going to be kind of mad at yourself.
I was learning how to edit double files, so the separate left and right files, the other day, and I was listening back to the edit and it was so much better quality than the ones that I was doing when I didn't know that, and I thought I'll just go back and listen to a previous episode. Got 10 minutes in and I was like, I'm gonna have to redo all of them because it's nowhere near as good. And
no, yeah. My early audio, people were enjoying how unprofessional it was.
I hope that's what they're, that's not what they're, I hope they are and aren't thinking, I really like how unprofessional Simon is.
Well, I think it was because it was no filter, no editing, and kind of dodgy audio. For instance, a road trip my son and I did across the outback. We didn't have lapel mics or anything. We just got a little Yeti microphone and just stuck it in the middle of the car. And because of that, it was very intimate conversations between me and my son, and we hashed out a lot of stuff. And because you can hear the air conditioning, the rev of the camper van, people felt like they were really there. However, podcaster friends of mine are like, it's horrible. It's unlistenable. Because I think once you get even just a taste of how to do audio, bad audio really bothers you. But I should give a shout out. There's a guy called Toby. You can follow him on Twitter. I think he's foo_cough, foo_cough.
I thought you were going to say Toby Haddock. I thought you were talking
It's a... what is Toby's surname? Toby Riding. He's a fan of the show. He approached me at a gig and he went, I can show you how to do everything. Also, if you've got a problem with files, send them to me because it bothers me. And so quite often I will get great audio, but there's just an issue with it and I just don't have the skill set. Yeah, he works for Apple and Universal when it comes to sound editing. So he polishes a lot of my turds. And I feel bad every time I send it, but he is just like, look, first of all, as a fan of the show, I get the raw footage. And second of all, as a fan of the show, I can't listen to what you put out sometimes. I can't stomach it.
Yeah.
We had an issue only recently where I did a black gig in Birmingham. And I started talking about doing black American gigs. And, you know, things are very, very toxic racially right now. And the thing is, this is a routine I would normally do. But because it was in an art center in Birmingham, and I'm talking about black shows in New York, they were kind of going, is he confusing us with
Birmingham, New York,
black New Yorkers?
Yeah.
And then like, and it was super fucking awkward. And then I did some bits that actually got, like, it was super fucking weird. And he did such a good job of, because I lost them completely in the middle. And it was my fault. And I really wanted to put the awkwardness up. And so he did a great job of actually, like, he's just like, he was, while he was editing it, he was like, oh my God, I've got this in my headphones and this is just cringeworthy. And that's actually, thank God, where I learned how to use the Zoom direct into computer, because I could then stop and yell at myself while I was on stage.
Yeah.
It kind of broke it up. But it's, you were saying earlier that made me laugh about once you start doing DIY, it ends up, go on.
Yeah, well, no, okay. So I'm learning calligraphy. And to do that, I'm using YouTube because I'm a visual learner, so that's good for me. And I've been watching this guy for about 3 months, like, and it's always silent, and he always just shows you the lines. And then he did this video, like, doing a crowdfunding thing, and he's 7. And I felt so, like, not, emasculated is the wrong word, but you know when you just think to yourself, how are you that, I mean, you must not go out and just do that all the time. And I get it, because there's not a lot to do when you're 7 now, like there was when I was 7, or when you were 7.
I was busy lighting the fire while you were telling me that story, but actually, it just off air, pre-record, you should have heard the incredulousness of I said, we've got teenagers teaching us how to live, and you went, never mind that, he was 7! He was 7! I wish he was 14. I was hoping for 14. The kid was fucking 7.
Well, here's the thing. Okay, right, here's the thing. Be good at something at any age. That's fine, right? And if you put the hours in, I'm not ageist in any way. I think if you put the hours in and you're good at something, it doesn't matter to me that he's 7. However, to do a crowdfunding campaign to, like, launch...
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, you know what I mean? Like there's a whole new level of, like, you're going to be, like, managing the team that don't win on The Apprentice in 5 years. Like, you're going to be that dickhead who, like, helps them through something.
I don't know about that. It's, for instance, my son... There's a lot of ways for a teenager to be a millionaire now.
Yeah.
And they don't have to, like, be the Alan Sugar going down the... Yeah, yeah. My son is 17. A friend of his is already financially independent. He was financially independent at 16 because he came up with an app.
Which app?
The Would You Rather app.
Okay, I've heard of that one.
Yeah. Yeah, and my son writes some of the Would You Rathers for him. So he employs his friends.
Nice.
So, like, you know, that kid's going to be
yeah
minted by the moment, like, school isn't in his way anymore.
Yeah,
you know what I mean? Like, that's someone that school is in their way.
Well, the problem I've got with that is so I think I've been listening to Justin Bieber a little bit recently, right?
What, like, the fuck for?
Listen. He can sing, right? You can say what you want about him. He can actually sing,
yeah,
right? As in, legitimately, off mic, no reverb, all that stuff. I think he can actually properly
sing. That's how we started. It was YouTube, wasn't it?
Yeah, exactly, yeah. So I was listening to him because I thought, I've never really given him a chance. And my mate was talking about how, like, good he is at some song. And I was listening to it, and I don't like that he sings about love, because I don't think at his age he's got a clue. But also, he's shit. Like, when you Google his name, the stuff he's doing is awful. But then I was thinking, if I was a millionaire pop star at, like, what is he, 19, and I'd never had a no, like, for years, and I had all the money that meant that legal systems didn't really matter anymore, I don't think I'd be much better. Do you know what I mean? Like, I'd be awful.
Yeah.
I think that's the problem, is that, like, if you make it, your son's friend, I don't know, I'm sure he's lovely, but if he has that amount of money now, if he gets, like, 25 and doesn't have to worry about anything, I just can't imagine him becoming the best person he could possibly be.
You know what? He was, I met him at his graduation, and he had a good head on his shoulders, and my kid is surrounded by just, you can tell, just good-natured kids. They're not the jocks. They're not the dicks. They're not over-popular. They're the in-betweeners. I'm kind of... It's funny, I had my son on the show recently. My son and I do the show regularly, as does my wife and I, and ratings are up when they're on.
You were saying to me that before.
Yeah, and the thing is, both Luke and Bean, my wife, argue... It's not about us. It's I think fans of yours want to see more of an insight into your life. And I'm like, okay... That would be the case if it didn't keep on happening, and actually also the online response when they're on. Like Ben and I did a Trump reaction, and it's a good counter as well of just rather than me bouncing off another comic all the time or just yelling into the abyss, it is nice to just have the more grounding forces in your life balance it out. I think it shows a more rounded human being. And I'd say that would be the case, you know, if the response wasn't such. People, you know, they have their favorite episodes and so on, but whenever they're on, it's always Twitter lights up, Facebook lights up. And then, like, if you Google my name, the number one thing that comes up is wife.
Hello, just wife. Just autocorrect. Brandon Burns. You mean wife?
Brandon Burns' wife.
Yeah.
And there's no pictures of her. It's funny, actually. I think the presumptions of who she might be is kind of like if you go into Google Images, there's no images of Bean there.
Is that?
Because it's not a real name.
Okay, fair enough. Because you introduced me to her as Bean, so I presumed it was her name. Because do you know what I did? This is slightly off topic, but a friend of mine, I can't tell you who because I promised him I wouldn't say who he was, but he's had a stage name and he's always given me his stage name. And recently he had to send me some money. And it came through as a different name. And he just went, oh, that's my real name, by the way. And I had like 10 minutes where I went, how have you never mentioned this to me before? Like, it's a logistic thing because of his day job. But I was like, you'd think at some point, because we're actually mates and stuff, you'd think at some point that would come up or that you'd mention it.
I think I didn't find out about Jeffries for the longest time. Jim Jeffries.
Oh, that... Not his real name. Oh, no, I knew that was his... Yeah, like, I thought that was a stage name from when I heard it, just because it sounded like one.
Everyone then... Yeah, people think mine is as well, because of the double B.
Oh, no, I didn't think yours was.
Particularly because it's Brendan with an O.
Oh, okay. No, I've got a pretty good gauge for stage names, but his is... I'll tell you afterwards, but it's...
Is it Liam Malone?
No.
Because he's got... He didn't... I was like, oh, that's a cool name, and he's like, yeah... No one seems to understand it's a pun. Leave him alone.
Leave him alone. Ah, okay. No, I didn't get the pun, but I thought it
was... Yeah, no one does.
Oh, okay.
And now he's stuck with it.
I had, do you know Ray Peacock? On.
Ray Peacock, yeah.
Yeah, right. I had him on a few months back, and we were talking about how he's had to change his name back to his real name.
Yeah.
Because rapey wasn't a word when he started out, or it wasn't like a cultural word as such. And as a result, he was saying that the character that he came up with was based on a real person he knew called Ray Peacock.
Right.
And he went along with it. And slowly people started thinking it was a name, like as in a joke name.
Yeah.
And he got to the stage where he's now thinking, I've had to go back to my real name.
Ian, isn't it?
It's Ian Boldsworth. Yeah.
Ian Boldsworth, that's right.
But he was like, I just can't stand the amount of people that think I think rapey cock is a funny pun. And I was like, okay. I mean, I get it. It would annoy me if people...
I think he might be bullshitting a bit. I think actually when he started out, that's what... And times have changed. I'm not entirely sure of that.
Okay.
I'm not entirely sure of that. I think, actually, you know, when he started out, like everyone, he wasn't very good. And he thought, hey, Rapeycock. And, you know, and I think that was like early noughties, late 90s.
Yeah, he was late.
He started in a very non-PC comedy era. Yeah, I'm not sure about that.
Here's the thing. I didn't get the pun until someone...
I didn't either.
Yeah, someone had to say to me, like, say it to me really slowly to make me get it. And I felt... It was a seven-year-old again. And I...
It was a seven-year-old again. Oh, you had me. Your delivery then, there was no...
Yeah, I know.
There was no facetiousness in the delivery.
But it was just such a weird moment where it clicked and I was like... Oh, that is actually the worst stage possible name for if that is what it's meant to mean. But I suppose it doesn't matter now because he doesn't get
it. When someone explained it to me, I was like, oh, really? And I'm not exactly, you know, a PC act per se.
No.
Although I would defend the morality of everything I do, but I don't know. I'm working on something now about maybe... I had Tom Ballard on the show, and it was good to have him on because he and I were going back and forth. And it was interesting that whilst we were in it, we thought we were arguing, and then listening back to the audio, it was actually we were agreeing emphatically.
But just coming at it from different angles.
Yeah, but yeah, but yeah, 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 yeah, but yeah. And loads of that. My argument was I've lived through PC before, and last time the backlash was grunge music, the Attitude Era in WWE, edgy comedy, and Marilyn Manson. people like that. This time the backlash is fucking Trump's in the White House.
Yeah.
And it just gets worse every time. So the more PC you get, the worse the backlash is. And I was arguing that by calling people racist, sexist, homophobes at the drop of a hat without really analyzing it, and also without really considering that in itself is very mean. That's the worst thing you can call people these days.
This is the thing that I was getting at.
Yeah. It's up there with racial slurs.
Yeah.
And without really analyzing it and calling things politically correct and politically incorrect, then Trump gets to get away with saying just racist shit. Just outright racist lies half the time, and then gets to call it politically incorrect. And so it actually works for the other side. Now, the other side has the handle on censorship. Anyone left of center and right of center warned about this. We warned you about this. Like, you're feeding the golem. And the golem, you know what happens in that story? The golem eats you. Not Lord of the Rings golem. Is it German mythology? Not mythology, folktale? Golem is taken from something else.
Do you want me to Google it?
Possibly, yeah. Isn't it funny how like brains are now remote?
I'm sure there's a child.
I had to give you directions to get here because it's everyone delegates certain parts of their brain.
Yeah.
Of like, I knew full well when I told you how to get here, you just thought, I will drive there and then ring him.
Well, here's a bit, actually, right, this is the truth of it. When you said to me, you I'm not going to give you directions, but when you said to me, go to this landmark, and we're just down the road. We're just down a little cul-de-sac next to it. I can leave that in, right?
That's fine. Yep.
I said to you, fine. And I put in the name of the place you told me to put in.
Yeah.
And Google sent me like two streets around the corner from it, which is weird.
Oh, because, Google's, a bit fucked up.
Yeah. And I remember pulling over. And the reason I was 15 minutes late instead of like five was because when I pulled over, I actually texted a friend to say, I don't want to ring him.
Because you'll call me a millennial cunt.
Yeah.
And
and you know why?
Come on, I'm adorable.
Here's the thing. So this is, you want to know the truth of the matter? I text my friend, and I can show you the conversation. I text her and I said, I don't want to ring him. We've already done this interview once. He's letting me come around his house. I don't want to add to this.
And we're the only landmark in this village.
Exactly, yeah. I don't want to add to the antagony. I can't even think of the word.
Antagonistic.
I don't want to add to this at all. So could you do me a favor? My Google doesn't seem to be giving me another address. Can you search for the postcode that he gave me? And she searched for it and she gave me the exact same thing. And I went, I'm going to have to ring him. And she went, oh, no, it'll be fine. You know what I mean? You're probably blowing out. You know, you blow stuff out of proportion. She went, no, it'll be absolutely fine. I went, I bet you any money he yells at me. First thing you did, you picked up the phone and went, you're the worst.
Yes, but it's all bluster.
I know.
Anything. It saddens me sometimes. I saw an interview with John Robertson, right? He was talking about, he did a show about a friend committing suicide. And then he told a story to the interviewee about someone yelling at him about it. And they said, he mentioned my name to begin with because I said, are you sure you want to do this? Maybe you want to process this in real life before you turn it into comedy. And then he told a story about someone yelling at him about, you know, this painful moment in his life. And the interviewer said, well, that sounds like Brendan Burns. And Robertson had to correct him and go, no, he was, you know, it was a horrible time. He was actually really quite kind. It saddens me that's my reputation with some people that I think probably don't really understand my work or have, I don't know, just got something via gossip.
I spoke to Jeff Whiting about this a while ago. He runs Murph Control. And he said, the problem is that, so say he doesn't book a comedian and then a week later he doesn't book another comedian. And comedian one comes out with an idea of why they weren't booked. And then comedian two comes up with the same idea. And then they meet at a gig. And they say, oh, he didn't book me. I think it's because of this. They then believe the idea that they've come up with between them. And then tell someone else. And it pushes gossip around the thing. And then the person who they've come up with the idea about doesn't get a chance to defend themselves. Because obviously they don't know it's happening.
Right.
And I think that kind of chat happens all the time. I mean, even before we started, we were chatting about people, and it's kind of like, I mean, we weren't making any assumptions, thankfully, but we could easily have done, and we could easily have filled in the blanks, and then gone away with that, and then later on when we think about it, we might not have remembered it as well as we might want to, and then as a result, that impairs our judgment on someone.
Yeah, definitely that's part of it. And also, it might have something to do with, like, who was on the show? Phil Wang and Sam Simmons. And they both said they were very intimidated by me before they met me. I'm 5'10 and three quarters, right? Also, where I grew up, I'm a performer, right? I'm a needy performer like anyone else. So in my circles, when I was growing up, I was the flowery one. It's hilarious. I remember once telling my dad when he was calling me a big girl for some reason. And I went, do you know that in my industry, I'm kind of considered a man's man? And my dad just cracked up. And he went, what? You? So to further that idea, like both Sam and Phil said, yeah, I was very intimidated until I got in the car with you. And you were very, you know, you were very nice and you're really supportive when people are starting out. Might be the deaf thing and a slightly booming voice. And I'm not particularly intimidated by audiences. So then maybe people will think that that translates somehow to real life. Of like, if an audience is belligerent, I can be belligerent. If I don't, if an audience pisses me off, I can, and I let them know that. But that, you know, I couldn't live my life like that. You know, you can't, I don't think anyone can be their act 24 hours a day. I tried once and it nearly killed me.
I know you a little bit, but I don't know you well enough to know the difference between your on stage and off stage. So what's the major difference between Brendan, I know I'm going to refer to it as a character even though it's not, but Brendan the onstage persona, let's go with that, and
these days very little.
So you are yourself all the time?
No, I'm probably more authentic now than I was then. Look, I think there was a label that, look, first of all, you know, people are lazy. I've always been an emotive performer, right? Very emotional performer. And sometimes if I was angry about something, that would manifest itself. And anger is the most obvious one. It's easiest one to spot. It's the easiest one to label. And yet, if you were to ask people that come to actually pay money to see me and listen to the podcast, and you know, I don't really filter that much out. You know, I'm not trying to sell a better version of myself than the one that exists. I think, to be honest, there's too much of that. I think a lot of comics, I will see them up on stage spouting their left-wing values, and off stage, they're really kind of bigoted, and they don't know that they... Some know they are, and some don't know they are. And I'm watching them sell this version of themselves, and I'm like, you're not... This isn't you. You're not this nice. You're not this decent a person. And so I kind of made a commitment when I started doing the podcast of, right, I'm going to go all out. To begin with, it was just me spouting my frustrations with the industry. And then I then soon found out that people were listening. And thought, oh, I'd better put some effort into this, because the first couple of episodes are fucking unlistenable. It's just, I thought, you know what, why am I trying to be right about everything all the time? Why am I committing to funny? And funny just involves letting your crazy moron speak sometimes. Just letting your crazy moron fly. Rather than trying to sell a smarter version of you, a higher, more moral version of you, it just doesn't exist. It's just not real. And I just, and to be honest, when I see that, I see through it, and it doesn't make me laugh. I'm like, I'm done. I tune out. Once I committed to that, then the more people started listening and turning up to shows, and I was able to tour off the back of it. These moments are very personal and intimate for people, and they're not, and they feel a very, very real attachment to you. So I would argue that whilst there are some that would write, he's an angry comic, he's an in-your-face comic, he's a whatever, I think true fans of mine would go, I don't think you know him like I do. I think when people can feel that way about you, it then creates a very, very personal relationship. Fucking hell, I had a guy, particularly now between having my wife on the show and my son on the show, having my son on the show, because he's very honest with me, I now also get like guys that are maybe 10 to 15 years younger than me wishing I was their dad. And I had a guy last night, this is the first time this has ever happened, I've noticed that this tour more than any other, is that guys are coming up and saying that they're starstruck and they didn't expect it. And I'm like, you're not, because I'm not that famous. It's just that I'm really in your life. I'm there while you're on your way to work. I'm there in your quiet moment. I'm in your moments to yourself.
So I'll let you finish the story. I was going to say something very similar.
And so this guy, this is last night, and I rang Bean immediately. I rang away. I've never had anything like this. So this guy was a bit drunk, right? And he's there with his missus, and he wanted to convey to me how much the show meant to him, and that, like, you know, he's actually gone through a depression and it lifted him out of it. Because I think when I started the show, I was definitely in the middle of being quite depressed. And he goes, "You don't know what the show means to me. It just, it really got through my, and I'm working night shifts now, and it's just what gets me through it." And then he goes, "Can I have a photo with you, me and my missus?" And he did a bit too much to drink, and his missus is on my right and he's on my left, and he just hugs me, but looking for that hug that his dad obviously never gave him.
Oh.
But he dry humped my leg a bit. And then leant in, he did, and he couldn't help himself. And in my ear, he made this noise. "Brendan."
Oh. So sweet and creepy.
And creepy at the same time. I went, I think it just came on my leg. Like, I couldn't help myself. I pissed myself laughing.
I thought you were saying pissed on him. They're like,
no, I fucking cracked up, because I've been in that moment. I remember when I met The Rock, Dwayne Johnson. And those guys are amazing at giving people their time as well. I learned something from it. The way that he treated me was, I was, again, going through a very, very heavy depression and working on quite an alcoholic, drug-induced career. I hadn't left the house for I hadn't smiled in 3 months. It was after a rather very heavy-duty breakup, and I was on a crash course to nothing good.
So when people say things like that, I imagine them actually crossing off days going, not today.
Not okay. Today. Not rock bottoming today.
No smiling today.
Oh, I see.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, I mean, I even still have the scars on my face, the lines from not smiling.
Oh, really?
Yeah. You see Obama when he came out after the when he walked out with Donald Trump?
Yeah.
You see that sad, thin smile, the grim?
Yeah.
And it's like, but there's a furrowed brow with it.
Yeah.
Yeah. If you do that for a year or so, which is definitely what I did. I've seen photos from that time, and every photo I'm just so sad.
One of my favorite photos of all time is the one of Obama and Trump sitting in the White House, and it's that moment where you've got a mutual friend who's gone to the toilet and you've run out of things to say. It looks like that. It looks like they're just so
I think what kind of happened was, it was supposed to be a 15 minute mini meeting and it went 90 minutes, and Trump went, how successful is that? It was supposed to be 15, it went 90. And it's because that's because he had to explain to you everything that you physically can't do.
Well, no, I have a lot more respect for, I had a lot of respect for Obama before, but did you hear that he's now offered to mentor him, as in to help him through the first 6 months of it, which I think's amazing character for a person of another party.
Yeah.
To go, you know what, I'll walk you through how this works for the first 6 months.
I think also he probably pointed out to him, this system that you claim you're going to tear down is the only thing keeping you alive for the next 6 months. And I think he probably told him a bunch of, I remember when Thatcher stepped down, before her death, Thatcher admitted, when you're prime minister, they take you into a room and they tell you a bunch of things that only the prime minister can know. And you age 8 years that day. Every single prime minister and president ever since then has gone grey overnight, except for Bush. Didn't seem to give a fuck. I'm guessing he already knew.
Yeah. he's got the look of someone who knew it and thought, actually, I want to know more.
And then I think, Trump came out absolutely terrified and went, oh, the only thing keeping me alive is this guy. Because it's not the lefties that are going to get, they've got broom handles. It's his lot. The far right, when it turns out he can't do half the stuff. Anyway, I'm going into shtick now.
I've got
bits on this.
I've got a running kind of friendly bet with a friend of mine that someone out in America has a bullet with his name on it, but they're waiting because they want to know they've killed President Trump, not president-to-be Trump. You know what I mean? Because who wants to be the guy that killed the guy that was getting...
It'll be one of his far-right people.
Yeah.
They're armed to the teeth.
Oh, yeah.
Bean made the joke the other day, I think, even on the show. Was it, if there is someone pulling the strings, if there is someone pulling all the strings, of course they went with pissing off the left. Because they riot with broom handles.
Yeah.
The other lot don't get their way. They're tooling up with hummers.
Yeah. What? Yeah.
So we digressed. What were we talking about?
I feel like it's going to keep coming back to Trump. It seems to be with all my conversations these days.
Oh, my God.
But, he is a example of... I can't really make I can't segue it back into my podcast, my general, topics for the podcast. But he does make a lot of people who previously didn't have a voice or previously didn't feel like they could speak up, who are sexist, racist, misogynistic, come out and speak.
Well, also, and we are partially responsible for that. I don't know where you're leaning. I'm left of center.
I'm left on every issue that I've educated myself on.
Yeah.
Because I haven't educated myself on everything. So I don't like saying I'm left, because there might be an issue at some point where I'm right.
I would never commit to a single socio-political exactly. agenda, which is why sometimes the left hasn't quite embraced me. And yet I'm like, on what issue am I not?
Yeah, but I just haven't... I'd rather not say I'm fully left, because... If it's a bit like when you're born and your parents go, you're this religion, and you're like, I've not done any research into this. Like, I don't want to just tie myself into this label. And
Or tie yourself to it because you've been told that that's just the right way to think.
Well, yeah, this is the thing. I mean, I'm the guy who at Brexit was tweeting saying, look, if you're voting out, could you just tell me why? Because I don't want to have a go at you. I don't want to belittle you. That's your vote. And I don't think I'm going to be able to convince you otherwise. But tell me why, because I just need to know why you would vote out, because I can't find a reason for myself to do that. And I got retweeted by, I think it was called like the Leave, like, you know, Twitter handle or something like that. And it had like 100,000 followers. And I got mauled by loads of people going, this lefty fucking idiot wants to, you know, learn about, and I was like, yes, I do.
Yeah.
But then loads of people after that wave came over to me and were like, right, I'm voting out because I want stop on immigration. I want my country back. I want this. And then some people were like, oh, I just don't think that, you know, we get much out of being in it. Or I just don't understand why we need to be in it. We've been in it for so long and I don't see it. You know, all this, like...
Well, it got sold on a racist ticket. And then we on the left got played like a fiddle in that they would use racist rhetoric. They had racist billboards. Look at these brown people coming. And we all went, look how racist that is. And then racists went, wait, I can vote for racism? And now they're running around acting like they won something because we labeled it that and we helped label it that. Is the right used it and we advertised it. And then now we have these horrible stories of people walking up to people in the street, and it's happening in America now as well, of people going, get out, Trump won.
Yeah.
Racism won.
It's a total misunderstanding of, right, just because someone's been elected, like you said, just because they've been elected on those policies, A, doesn't mean they can implement those policies, and B, doesn't mean they want to. I'm convinced that half of the stuff Trump said, he said for publicity more than what he was going to want to do.
I think he even admitted that he listened to right-wing radio. Also, he just said things that got a clap. And once it was like people cheered something, he went, oh, that worked. I'll say that.
My biggest problem with Trump is something that I've not seen anyone, at least in the mainstream media, covering. And it's the lie he sells, which is that your feelings are more important than your rights. And I don't think that's fair to say. He goes up and he gives you a feeling.
That's a bit. Huh? That's a bit of the latest show.
Oh, I've not seen your latest
show. But I say it about PC. And I say, just here to tell you kids that your rights are important, your fucking feelings aren't.
Okay, I've not seen your show.
No.
I didn't come here to tell you your own joke.
No.
But that's the thing that winds me up about him, is he gets up and he gives you a feeling.
Yeah.
And then in the middle of that feeling goes, also we hate immigrants. And then moves on really quickly. And you're still reeling from that feeling going, woo, yeah. And then you just ignore that he said horrible things. Whereas he can't say anything to protect your rights or to do anything with those, because that would involve being good at the job.
Yeah.
And he's not good at the job.
No.
So he's like, and I keep comparing him to Russell Brand in many ways, because Russell Brand's videos, you watch those. I watch those sometimes. And at the end of it, I'm like, yeah, there's going to be a revolution. And then a cat video comes on and I go, I'll deal with a revolution in a bit. I'm enjoying the feeling. This feeling's good.
Well, I think Russell is distancing himself from that now because maybe self-awareness has kicked in, and that he vacationed in Africa. And it was kind of, unfortunately for him, I think every performer and every comedian and every performer at some point goes through some sort of messianic complex when people are clapping and applauding you. Unfortunately for him, he did it at the height of his fame. There's a guy that used to do heroin, right? So that's an addictive personality. He got movies, he got a TV show, married to the number one pop star on the planet. And somewhere the addict in him went, it's not enough. I got to be Jesus.
Like, yeah.
I've got to be Jesus. None of that was enough. It was like, you know what? I'm going to heal the world. And of course, fucking broke white working class people. It's so funny now that so many celebrities are confused. But I said I wanted Hillary. But I stepped up and it's like, they don't relate to you. They're like, fuck you. You're minted. Don't tell me how to live. Don't, you know. And I think somewhere when people were just calling people racist, sexist, misogynists, homophobes or whatever, at the drop of a hat, I think, while no one was watching, anonymously, a whole bunch of people went, I'll fucking show you. I'll fucking show you racist, sexist, misogynist.
I don't think it was a conscious, like, flash mob of voting. I think it was a hive mind of everyone realizing, oh, we can't say it out loud. Yep. We can say it in the booth.
And now that it's happened and it's kind of policy, well, yeah, they think it's policy, now they're saying it out loud.
Here's the thing. I want racists to be vocal in the sense that I want to know who is racist so I can talk to them and understand why they are. Because otherwise, there's no way of even understanding it, let alone working on trying to change their point of view. If you're quiet about it and you only talk about it with your mates, you get that loud culture thing of, you know, oh, we're just bantering. And it's like, you're not though, are you? Because you mean
her. I don't know. I mean, the Trump grabbing by the pussy thing, that brought up, I think, a lot of questions for a lot of guys. Sorry, I didn't let you finish.
No, go on.
I, at first, forgive me if this sounds like shtick, because it is. It's a bit, but I'll just do the point, not the jokes.
Yeah, don't make this podcast funny or anything. I'd hate to break.
Heaven forbid.
I hate to break with convention on this one.
Well, because what is the topic anyway? I suppose it's DIY, isn't
industry.
It?
It's about the industry, but the thing is, inherently, the industry is informed by politics more and more anyway. So, because in terms of business dealings and in terms of the way that people perceive, first of all, mainstream, but also what's sellable.
Yeah.
And what's allowed to be said. I think politics is definitely something that we can discuss and we can move into.
I suppose it does move into the DIY thing because the podcast, I think anyone that starts one, it morphs into what it's going to be.
Yeah.
And eventually, after a while, I was like, I'm in a different country every other day. I'm writing a new 20 minutes in front of different cultures. And I was raised on the UK circuit to think that no one has a sense of humor about themselves but white British people. And that just hasn't been my experience. So, yes, it's, and I've had to have a look at this recently, in that in the show I have been addressing that maybe left of center and right of center need to come together because we're in the middle of a war on reason, but also the idea of punching up, punching down, all of that, and political correctness compartmentalizes into white and other, and it still sells white as superior.
I think that's media driven more than anything at this point. Yeah. Like I think the media have a narrative that means that, and that's the one they're sticking with. And they could easily, I mean, for example, if Murdoch wasn't the owner of all of the things that he's the owner of, and someone else took over tomorrow and wanted to make another race the predominant one on that, or the superior one of those, I think that would have a ripple effect against absolutely all of that.
But I think, and I've learned from doing the show of just talking to people, because people label black as just black. And it's like, Europe ain't shit. Europe isn't shit. Europe isn't even a billion people. We're fucking nothing, right? Africa is like, what, 52 countries or something?
Yeah.
It's massive, right? So many languages, so many cultures, so many subcultures. Everyone just goes black. And I'm like, what the fuck? You know, Asia. It's just everyone else eats us. And the idea that we still refer to other ethnicities as ethnic minorities and it is politically correct to do so. I'm sorry. That's...
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hey, Dave.
Yeah, Randy.
Since we founded Bombas, we've always said our socks, underwear, and T-shirts are super soft. Any new ideas?
Maybe sublimely soft.
Or disgustingly cozy.
Wait, what?
I got it. Bombas. Absurdly comfortable essentials for yourself.
And for those facing homelessness.
Because one purchased equals one donated.
Wow, did we just write an ad?
Yes.
Bombas, big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase.
Just not right. Technically, ethically, emotionally, statistically, on every level, that's wrong. Because it's we're the minority, and that's okay.
But it's like you said, people are lazy. It's easy to just go, they're black, or they're Chinese, or whatever it would be, and not sort of think, hang on, I wouldn't like it if someone said, oh, you're a Londoner, like, and just batch me together in just that group of people.
Yeah.
Because a South London person is different to a North London person, or a West London, or whatever, you know what I mean? There's so many nuances and variations between how you've been brought up and economic, whatever, you know?
Yeah.
So if I would be insulted by that, I work as best I can not to, in my head especially, because that's where it happens sometimes. Like, it doesn't happen out loud very often because I don't believe in it, and I only like to say things I believe. But in your head, sometimes it auto-corrects and does that, you know, stupid, oh, it's all the same there. Yeah. Just yes. To make your life easier. And I don't like it at all, but it happens. And I think
we've demonized it too much that no one wants to own the moments, and it's so much easier to point the finger elsewhere. And that's certainly something I've learned from doing the show is, first of all, anyone that declares themselves as woke, fuck off.
I don't even know what that is.
Woke means you now understand the Black Lives Matter movement and everything, and it's all kind of very self-congratulatory and self-defining and very self-important and kind of, to me, it's kind of pompous. But from interviewing people of different sexuality, ethnicity, and gender to me, somewhere along the way, we confuse curiosity with bigotry. Now, I'm a straight white male. I live on a farm. I was raised in Perth, Western Australia.
Yeah,
shit I don't know.
Can I pause you very quickly? As you were saying before, people preconceive you as a bit of a man's man masculinity thing. When I arrived here, this is not where I thought you lived. I did not think, yeah, Brendan, he'll live on a farm. He'll live, like, and it's not your farm either. You live in a cottage on someone else's farm.
Yeah.
And it was like this moment where I was like, I think he's hiding out here from the mafia. Like this,
the mafia.
Yeah. There's like something's happened and he's having to like redirect people. That's why you were like, come to this landmark. Don't
I'll
come
to teach
me.
You how to swing an axe if you want.
That in the dark.
Yeah.
Okay.
No, I mean, we had a farm when I was a kid.
So for you, all that 7-year-old.
Yeah. So London drove me mad as well. So I think I need to live remotely.
I like living where I live. But I was going to ask you about this because increasingly I've noticed, especially comedians who are full-time, in whatever capacity they define that as, they are increasingly not living in London. They're working in London, but they've moved either to the Midlands or a little bit out. And I feel priced out of London. I'm definitely not someone who earns enough, even with a day job and comedy, to live anywhere in zones 1-6. I mean, and that comes into politics again because of the way that that's come about. But I was going to ask you, go on, sir, I thought you were going to say something.
No, carry on.
I was just going to ask what you think about that move, because the industry is still seen as very London-centric.
I think in your first 10 to 15 years, London, New York, or LA, it's got to be one of those places so that you're surrounded by other comics and that iron sharpens iron, you know, and that you're tossing bits around, working off one another. I think maybe my work dipped when I first moved out here and I was also financially secure, which I think was the death of comedy.
Why were you, what, you mean you were making enough?
I just got lucky. I made a couple of lucky investments and I sold my house at the right time. So I kind of rested on my laurels a bit and I think I stopped being relevant. And then with that came a lack of drive, a lack of purpose, and I think somewhere under it, I was running away from acknowledging that I was probably in the middle of a bit of a funk.
When was that? What year was that?
Maybe about 5-6 years ago or something.
So you've been going how long?
27 next year.
So you've been going 22 years at that point.
Yeah.
When you moved out of London.
Yeah.
What was that? Because was that when you... Because you basically stopped doing circuit pretty much for a while.
It's funny, I heard an urban myth. I was on the Stuart Goldsmith podcast, he goes, I heard that once you won the Perrier, you rang up and cancelled all your gigs.
Did you
no,
do that?
No, never happened. Okay. But also, I've heard that rumour about 8 different comics when they won the Perrier.
why would you do that, though?
I didn't. I mean, there was...
Yeah, but what would be the reason why that would be a rumour that would come about? Like, is it a case of...
You just won the thing that everyone kind of wants to in the UK. Everyone kind of... Well, maybe less so now.
I'm not that fussed.
But before everyone was self-producing and DIY, pretty much the Edinburgh Festival was your only in. And it was also the only place where you were free to make your own content. No matter who you were, no matter what following you had a room, a time slot, and you were in the same place every night for a month. And you had time to work on something. and produce it. And, you know, so you still, you didn't know how to use technology yet, but you self-produced, and that was your in. And then to be nominated, and then that was, you know, that was the be-all kind of end-all for a good 15, maybe 20 years. So everyone always dreamt of winning the Perrier, now Edinburgh the Award newcomer. Or whatever. It was the hardest one to... No. There didn't even used to be a newcomer award. They only started that, I think, when Scott Capurro won it. No, Harry Hill. Harry Hill was the first ever newcomer. And I think they even made it up because he was so good but shortlisted. So I think, yeah, a lot of my generation, there was all of a sudden, you know, you find out who your friends are and aren't, and everyone has an opinion on you. Everyone has an opinion on your show without having seen it. And then I think I was pushed into a lot of, there was definitely a lot of square peg, round hole going on for a couple of years. But, you know, I did fairly well out of it, but I certainly discovered who I wasn't and what I wasn't capable of doing. I think there's a real tendency as well of like niche comics like myself that something we're not good at, we just pretend it's no good. You know, so they, you know, you hear guys go like, oh, that Live at the Apollo, fuck that. Or panel shows, I don't do panel shows. And it's like, you can't do panel shows.
Yeah.
You wouldn't be good at that. I'm better at long form. Like, even now, you're having a hard time getting a word in edgewise, and it's your show.
That's all right. You're making very good points, so I can't really fault it.
So a podcast is perfect for me because it's long form, and I can, and, you know, I produce everything. It's lit a fire under my ass. It's built this fan base. It's made doing this my way possible. Oh, here was the point I was going to make earlier. We've come full circle. So with the Trump thing and the left and the right and punching up and punching down and so much defining going on and people being exhausted and Brexit backlash and Trump backlash and some comics very confused right now because it's like, but we all took the piss. Why did that not work?
Surprisingly, your joke didn't change the world.
Yeah, surprisingly, your jokes didn't change the world. And I think people are just exhausted by us telling them how to think and being just a little bit condescending. And that's kind of what the show is about, is when I watch a guy on stage talk about Farage or just says everything that you're supposed to, I'm always like, all right, this is all well and good, but when were you racist? You know, when were you homophobic? When did you fuck up? And that's why the podcast is called Dumb White Guy. It's basically my flaws, and I try to own stuff. And I've been doing that for 3 years now, and I'm always guilty of everything I declare I'm not doing on the show. It always happens invariably. I will fall ass backwards into whatever I'm trying not to do, I will end up doing. And that's not intentional. It just happens that way. And then...
Well, no, but it's, you always become the thing you hate kind of thing, you know?
Oh, no. I just laugh and shrug it off in those moments. You know, if I'm interviewing a gay comic, I will no doubt do something homophobic, but I don't know any better. But, you know, I'm a straight white male, so I'm trying to understand them, but at the same time, trying to help them understand me. And then the Jonathan Pye video came out.
Which one?
The one about Trump. And
yeah,
the one
done like four on that.
Yes, okay, but it was the one that went viral recently.
Oh, yeah.
And he's tearing into the left by saying, stop yelling at people, sexist, racist, misogynist, and actually sit down and listen to one another. And my first thought was, I've been saying that for years.
Yeah.
Why didn't I go viral? And then I thought, that's it. That's what everyone's fed up of, because I'm a performer. And it's like George Carlin said. He opened a show one year, one of his specials with, let's be honest, you're here for me, I'm here for me, let's move on. And I think somewhere we want to own facts. Like, it's even happened during this interview, is you've said some things I've said and I've gone, oh, I've done that. Well, that belongs to me. And so I think as performers, people are sick to death of us not being honest, that we care more about ourselves than the message. And by acknowledging that and being honest, I think, with myself when I saw the Jonathan Pye thing, and I thought, whoa, what's that? And I thought, maybe that's at the forefront of this. And I've spoken to a couple of comics about it, saying, I'm struggling with my Brexit bit, or I'm splitting the room. Is anyone else struggling with this? And I think it's because, you know what? I think people see through it. I think, first of all, there's a contract, and the contract is you get to talk about yourself for 90 minutes, so long as the payoff is you make me laugh, release some endorphins, and take me away from my shitty life. Somewhere along the way, we lost that, you know, and somewhere along the way, we started being really disingenuous and started all white knighting it and letting our messianic complexes speak just a bit too fucking much. And, you know, what's her name? Katy Perry?
Yeah.
I think Katy Perry at the Hillary Clinton thing and Miley Cyrus, you know, bursting into tears afterwards going, but I'm so upset. I'm so upset. And everyone's like, fuck you. Fuck you, you spoiled child. And that's all we are. You know, if we get to do this for a living, we're spoiled children.
I think it's also kind of intrinsic to mainstream, and I use that term loosely because I don't like it as a term anyway, but mainstream audiences, because generally speaking, people who will watch TV comedy and then go and watch that TV comic at an arena, generally speaking, expect to have stuff reaffirmed rather than... And in fact, when we gigged together, you even said, one of the first things you said when you came off stage to me was how there was a heckler in the room who the one bit I made about the local area lapped it up and then started trying to make it about the audience in the room. Or do you remember? Yeah. And it was like, I was trying to do other things. I was trying to talk about other points and other things that have nothing to do with where we were in the country. It doesn't matter where we were. But it was this whole, you know, I think audiences, not all of them, but I think some audiences want to just hear about, and you've spoken about this before, want to hear about themselves in some ways. And
where am I in your act?
Exactly.
Selfies in the Grand Canyon. It's my latest special. It's up on Next Up Comedy.
There you go.
Yeah.
Go watch it. But after this, leave it streaming in the background. Leave it buffering in the background.
So I did it again.
Well, yeah, but I this is really refreshing because I've had, so my first show was about overthinking life and trying not to and failing to not do that, right? And this new show is becoming so much more about weird ideas that are just stupid and silly. And in between that, talking about how I'm ultimately anxiety ridden and flawed. And I don't know how to be better because I'm not talking to enough people from enough places to do that. That's not in the show, but it's just what I'm learning about it from talking about it. So the Michael Jackson joke that I did that you saw at the gig about how I saw a comedian saying that he was mad for changing his skin color, and I was saying I'd do the same if I was in America in the 1970s. Why would you not do that? You know, and it's like that. I mean, I've been talking to a black comic friend of mine about that, and I said I'm worried I'm being racist, and he went, no, I saw you do it when you first did it, and you sounded racist, and now you sound like you're on our side because you know that it was horrible.
Yes,
but it's because I spent time actually like looking into it and trying to understand what the point of it was, and it's like I don't want the audience going away from that with I think white's better.
Somewhere along the way,
and it's easy in that kind of area to do.
Somewhere along the way, and it is PC that did that. Black became an insult.
Yes. Well, even inherently in comedians, and I see this in my friends all the time, and I correct them a lot, because if they say they had an urban gig, I give, do you mean a black gig?
Yeah.
Because it's not an urban gig.
No. That was one of the scariest things Trump said to me. To me, that was one of the scariest things Trump said.
That's going
to
be a great upcoming episode of your podcast.
Interesting, isn't it? I think to reaffirm that idea as well is that people want to own facts. So you see some comics tweeting shit going like, I noticed this. And it's like, this is my fact. There's a lot of autodidacts. But the scariest thing to me that he said was at a rally, and there was not that much made of it. And he said they want to keep the polls open so that in the inner cities, certain people can vote. You know who I mean, but I'm not going to say who because I can't, but you know who I mean. Who doesn't live in the inner city? That effectively is a blanket statement of just whoever you fucking hate, whoever you're afraid of, I'm on board. Like, whoever it is, I'm on board. Because the inner cities, that's everyone. There's no one that, you know, that's where multiculturalism is. That's where different, you know, sexualities and sexual orientations are. That's like, it's the lot. It's everyone but you. Whatever you've got going on in your head, fucking vote for that. And I think that might have been the idea.
To tie it back to comedy, to sort of try and get back into industry stuff here, in terms of that kind of idea of comedians doing that sort of, not that sort of thing, but a similar thing of going, I'm going to aim for being, not middle of the, I suppose middle of the road is the best way of describing it without spending 5 minutes trying to think of a better term, but, you know, being middle of the road or being just as sellable as possible for a mass market if they don't want to do the DIY route, essentially. Because this route that I would say we're both on is not harder or less hard than what they're doing. Like you said, it's more of building a relationship with an individual than you might do if you just get chucked on TV and then chucked in an arena.
Oh, yeah. And there's a, you know, and there's a less negotiable contract.
Yes.
You know, it's like, do what I saw on telly. There's fucking thousands of us. I just did, Katie Wilkins has got a documentary coming up and it's kind of changed the course. And it is like the relationship between comedy and Trump and comedy and the left and the right. Again, I've been harping on it until I'm blue in the face of just like, comedy's the wrong fucking target. You know, it's the wrong, you know, I never finished talking to Tom about my conversation with Tom Ballard. He then argued afterwards, like, well, we both said actually simultaneously, we need to get rid of politically correct and incorrect. I've been working on something recently about, like, let's just start labeling things fucked and not fucked. Because I remember the first time around, the first cycle, the reason that my generation rebelled against political correctness and incorrectness was it started with alternative comedy and they labeled themselves non-sexist, non-racist. Sounded pretty nice, all well and good. I get that it was a backlash to the working class men's clubs of the Dickie Bow and there were the two black fellas, the Bernard Manning backlash. Now, what I've argued with that generation that were rebelling against that is that's not the London you live in anymore. This is now the feeder system to the world circuit. And there are comedians from around the world that grew up watching Eddie Murphy, Richard Pryor, Carlin, people who did address race, that did address culture. And you live in a multicultural society and it should be addressed and it should be okay to make jokes about it, not made up white stereotypes, because that's what that previous music hall, I don't know what you call them, 70s comedians shit was. It was white lies. I get why you want to rebel against that, but I've never seen it.
Sorry, in my head, the reason I laughed at that was because I had white
lies. Yeah, fair enough.
Nothing to do with that.
But you know what I mean? It was just, there was a black fella. He was a thief. And anyway, he raped my wife or whatever. Now, I never saw that guy. He wasn't relevant to me. So I don't know. And you can't ask, now that you have a cultural hub and a world hub, that this is the feeder system to the international circuit, you're going to have to adapt. Because also, once they stopped calling it alternative comedy, non-sexist, non-racist, and they started labeling it politically correct and incorrect, as satirists, it was our job. Satirist comedy's poor cousin. As comics, it's our job to call bullshit when we see it. And we were like, wait a minute. That's a fucking oxymoron. Politically correct and incorrect is a contradiction in terms that's supposed to be up for discussion. And now if you're all of a sudden just going to jettison what you think into politically correct and incorrect, and also, by the way, the truth doesn't figure in there, then fuck you. We're gonna kick back. So, yeah, we did, you know, really kind of ripped the piss out of PC for about 10 years. And then this time around, it got so insane. And maybe left of center and right of center need to come together because we're in the middle of a war on reason. And I get that leading up to the election, we all kept our mouths shut because we were trying to keep a demagogue out of the White House. But now it's maybe time that we got rid of our hystericals and stopped pandering to our more hysterical ends. Because on the left, our hystericals didn't vote. And on the right, theirs did this time. There is a war on reason. And the more hysterical elements of the left are fucking retarded. You know, they're apathetic. The left is never left enough. They are everything that the right wants to call all of the left. Right? On the right, there are colossal, gun-toting, insane, uneducated bigots. And they're on the far end of that. But people right of center aren't that. People left of center aren't that. So we need to stop calling each other those names. Because this is a very, very dangerous... This lack of discussion ended up somewhere really fucking dangerous.
It's the same as what you were saying before, where you say people batch all black people as black. People batch all lefties as left, even though there is a spectrum there. Same with the right. I've been guilty of this before as well, where I've just gone, oh, all the rights believe this. And it's like, do they though?
Yeah.
Because I've got a few mates who are more right-leaning than I am. I would not put them as fully right-leaning, much like I don't 100% say I'm fully left-leaning. But, you know, they're not racist in any way. They just have different beliefs in certain areas. And you can be right and not racist. You can be left and racist. And it's just weird to me how these things get lumped together. And in comedy, I find lazy comedy in that area uses that as the joke. They sort of stereotype a group of people and go, oh, hyperbole that stereotype, and that'll be the easy thing. The thing that really pissed me off during the election was lazy political comedians insulting how Trump looks. That is the last thing you should be insulting. He looks comical, and I suppose there are a million and one ways and a million and one things you could pick on him and say you don't look like I think you should look. But then, how are you any less racist than he is, turning to people that he doesn't like the look of and saying, I don't like them, they shouldn't be in my country.
But you can, however, turn it into, like, for instance, I have something now about people voted for him going, he's one of us, he's a billionaire, how's that? And then behind closed doors, it was like, yeah, but he's white. I'm like, he's not even that. He's like a weird Scouse orange, cheap joke or whatever. But it's still, it is a reflection upon how he looks, but it does kind of reinforce the stance.
Yeah, but
or lack thereof that he is taking.
But what I'd argue you're doing with that joke is you're taking the racist rhetoric of, oh, he's one of us because we're white, and making that absurdity look even more absurd. You're not necessarily, that joke to me is not about how he looks. That is about how they're reacting to how he is.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Whereas I've heard people make jokes about, you know, oh, his comb over looks ridiculous or whatever. And you're like, have you heard his policies recently?
I think also, like, or, you know, the lazy, don't fucking run before you can walk. There was one guy actually, he's hosted, and I've given him shit every time I've done his gig afterwards. Of Brexit is this year's Savile, Jimmy Savile.
Yeah, and I'm trying to work out how that's a thing.
Quick fit punchline. Like, you can just say it and not really done any work.
Yeah, but
so you can go, anyone vote Brexit? Are there any racists in? Right? And that's the joke. And it's like, really? That's...
How is it... I don't understand the Savile connection.
Okay, Jimmy Savile.
I know what Savile... I know who Savile
catch
is.
Catch your punchline, right? Like, you don't even have to be a particularly good comic to go like, die! You look a bit Jimmy Savile.
Right, so it's like going, this is a Holocaust or something. You know, it's just saying something horrible.
It's this year's Savile, in that, like, you don't really need any particular skill set. You don't need to have written a joke. You can get a cheap laugh in front of dumb cunts.
Yeah, you see, I didn't...
You can get a cheap laugh in front of the casual fan just by reaffirming whatever the hack stance is.
Mm.
And the hack stance is, who voted Brexit? You're racist. And I would argue that leading up to Brexit, there were some people that were just slightly right-leaning, sitting in that room, just with their heads hunched in, and then when no one was watching, anonymously, they got to go, fuck you, and tick leave.
Talking about DIY, we'll go to that.
Yes, that's what the topic was, wasn't it?
Yeah, I know. We talked for an hour and 15 before it.
we got round to the actual...
Well, no, but to be honest with you, I think a lot of what we've said is inherent in the industry, and you famously, I suppose...
Stopped. Really?
Well, you famously are going to say it. It was your Chortle thing that really, like, caught my attention for you, which was when you said, I don't really do clubs, I don't do them anymore. And your reasoning for it was succinct and was rational, and I think it's got worse in a lot of respects. And from what you've said, from when I heard it to now. And I mean, but I met you in a club, so I suppose you sort of do it on and off.
Yeah.
Now.
But I don't tour comedy clubs. The reasoning for that was, it wasn't an adversarial act. It was actually an act of cowardice, because I was, you know, I had the fan base. I could sell a certain number of tickets, and then I could spend several grand on trying to get an extra 20 bums on seats. And those 20 bums belonged to cunts. And I would have fans come up to me afterwards. The last special I did was called Selfies in the Grand Canyon, and it was about how much everyone needed to see themselves and everything. And even in that show, where I was explaining how much people needed to see themselves and everything, of where am I in your act? I live on the third floor. Like, not only do people want jokes about, you do jokes about toasters. I think it was, I became inadvertently the toaster guy. They want to hear jokes about your specific toaster, which I think someone told me they ended up attributing to Stuart Lee. It's funny, you write anything that chimes with people, it ends up being apparently Stuart Lee wrote it.
Yeah. Do you know, did I tell you I got reviewed in Chortle at the New Act of the Year three years ago? And Julia Chamberlain, the start of her review, said, the white skinny Stuart Lee for me. And I was like, oh, hello.
Hello, kitten. That's my three-legged cat. He's adorable, aww, isn't he? Skedaddle.
I'll come say hi in a minute.
Skedaddle. See, not so scary now, am I? Although I did cut his fucking leg off because he was talking shit. Babe, Skabobble's here. Skedaddle's here. He needs feeding. No, we're just wrapping up this interview. All right, he can wait. Fuck him.
I'm leaving that in. Everyone will know you're a heartless bastard. I'm going to leave that in.
Bug him. No, he's a fat cunt anyway. He's been eating too much. It's funny. I spoke to him a couple of years ago going like, do you know that you're like a sacred cow now? Because I think he's brilliant. I think he's hilarious. He makes me laugh. I even had him on the show. And I knew that was a double-edged sword to have him on the show because I knew his fan base was going to hate me. Admittedly, by my own flawed, and I labored over it for ages as well, because every comic apparently has heard the interview. And he's quite petulant at the top, but I also let professional jealousy get the better of me. And I think but I also attack his fan base, basically saying that he does cater to a fan base. He does stroke their ego a bit, that apparently they understand comedy better than comedians do, which he will, you know, completely admit off mic. That's fucking insane. That is preposterous. And I did think, like, this is probably going to be the most downloaded interview. Should I try and endear myself to these people? And then I thought, no, because I've seen the way they behave in his shows, and they're actually quite a mean-spirited crowd. And also, I don't spoon-feed anything, but there are some bits that he does that he spoon-feeds, and then the crowd congratulates themselves for getting it, which, to his credit, in the last season, he tears into them for, because of course he knows what he's doing better than that. Yeah, you know, sure enough, it got put up here, there and everywhere. And, you know, I get messages about once a week going, you're a terrible interviewer. It just seems like you're trying to assert yourself. And it's like, well, it's not an interview. It's a podcast. It's my show. And it's, you know, I've known him for years and we both respect each other. So just because you've never heard of me, deal with that. But in hindsight, I do think professional jealousy got the better of me, and I labored over it for ages, thought, should I change the intro to this and so on. I thought, no, fuck it, you know what, filter the crowd, filter the audience. You know, the whole point of the show is don't sell a better version of myself than the one that exists. Sometimes I am bitter, sometimes I am envious, you know, I am not adverse to playing bigger rooms, that's ultimately what I want to do, but it needs to be my lot. And there's some sort of really pretentious part of me that feels that an audience needs to have endured something to understand me. So I was going on the road, and even in this show, sorry, I segued terribly there, in a show that was about people needing to see themselves and everything, there was a guy, and it was at a reputable comedy club. It was at one of the best comedy clubs in the country, The Stand. Even at The Stand. And they had a mailing list of... It was the year that 150 comedy shows were touring. 150 comedians were touring comedy clubs. And I busted my ass to get these extra 20 seats. I sold the room out. Whatever. And this guy's sitting in the front fucking row on his phone, fidgeting with his phone, and he has to be the center of attention. I tear into him, and he does this thing where he histrionically waves his arms about and puts his hand over his head as if like, oh, I'm going to get it now. And then he just did that with every heckle, but he just kept on interrupting, stepping on punchlines, everything. Then towards the end of the show, he's at the bar. I've told him to shut the fuck up. And then they flash me the light because it's during the festival and they've got another show coming on or something. And I've only got 15 minutes to finish. And I said, shit, I've only got 15 minutes to finish. Okay, let me rush through this bit. And this fucking asshole makes a beeline for the front row, sits down in the front and starts doing it again. Has to be the center of attention. Had to make it about him. Needed to be about him. Could not, you know, just one of those people that doesn't know he just doubts his own existence until he's had it affirmed by the whole fucking room, waiting for his turn. And I was like, even in a show where I said the general public is waiting for their turn and needs to see themselves, even when we've just said to the room, I've only got 15 minutes to wrap up a closing bit that people have paid money to hear, you still had to make it about you. You can't. And I just said, look, just everyone in this room, let this guy know on the way out, like, you're selfish, that you ruined that for me. Like, don't let him get away with this. And so the fans came up to me afterwards and said, I've been waiting fucking months for this. I've been waiting months. And I thought, why the hell am I busting my ass to try and sell a ticket to that cunt? And so in the end, I just underpublicized and did anything but comedy clubs. Because I thought, why compete with their mailing list when I can't? Why try and sell 120 tickets when we know I can do 80 with no work? That I can do 80 to 100 seaters without any publicity, really, other than the show. And that's just the way I started doing it. And that became my business model. And I've never been happier. I look forward to going to work.
One of the problems with the votes was the echo chambers on social media. People had all their friends and anyone else they didn't agree with. They went, I saw people doing this where they were like, delete me if you're going to vote for Trump, or delete me if you're going to vote out, or whatever.
Yeah. And now we've got an echo chamber about the echo chamber.
Well, yes. But my question was going to be about, you've essentially created your own fan base using social media, but also using podcasts. And that comes with its own echo chamber in itself, because you're self-selecting people who want to invest in you. And I wondered how you deal with creatively moving forward and continuing to grow when, and I'm not saying they're all sycophants or anything like that, but there will be a portion of it in there in the sense of how you've gone about it.
Oh, thing is, because the show is me as a flawed individual, no one comes to me, to my shows, with the tell me what to think. Everyone comes, this is the kind of comedy I like. That's all it is. So I think they know full well the contract that I have signed is sometimes I'm going to say shit I don't mean, you know. Sometimes I'm going to write bits that contradict one another. That's something that, like, I want to interview Steve Bennett actually on the show, because he's falling into a trap that a couple of critics are, in that they start writing reviews and they're going, early on in the show he said this, yet later on he contradicts it. And it's like, yeah, it's a fucking comedy show. You're going to say shit you don't mean. There's a grain of truth in there, whatever, but it's the volume turned up. It's a joke. When did we forget what the fuck jokes meant? You know, I can take a feeling and turn it into funny. So the contract that I've signed with this audience is I'm going to say shit you don't agree with, but I'm not that committed.
Yeah, no,
you know, I'm going to say stuff I don't agree with. You know, I'm going to be facetious or whatever, but I'm just trying to work out a particular type of comedy. I'm just trying to be funny. Like, Bill Burr is one of the funniest guys on the planet right now. There was a couple of critics gunning for him at this year's Edinburgh, weren't there? But he says, like, I'm a fucking moron. I'm a contrarian. I remember he even said on the Joe Rogan podcast this week when Trump got in, he goes, I'm such an arsehole, right? He goes, I'm a professional arsehole. I just laughed my ass off when he said this. He goes, I agree with 90% of what feminists have to say until one of them says it.
Beautiful.
Isn't that fucking funny? You know, that's a funny fucking thing to say. And somewhere along the way, some people get a pass and others don't. You know, some people get a pass with some people and others don't. And thankfully, through the show, I've got a pretty multicultural crowd. Like, even in Edinburgh, which is like Whitey McWhitey Whitington. Whitey talking to Whitey about how racist Nigel Farage is. Ugh. And nothing sends other ethnicities from a room faster than that shit. But you sell yourself as the dumb white guy that's going to say dumb white shit, it's the room automatically becomes more diverse.
Do you know Aditi Mittal?
No, I don't.
No, she was the first female in India to do comedy as a professional. And she came over here and I interviewed her. And she basically said, she was just got back from Edinburgh. And the first thing, before I'd even asked her a question, she just went, it's really white up there, isn't it? And I was like, how much more white did you expect it to be than everywhere in this country? And she went, no, no, you don't understand. It's really white.
Yeah.
And like, and
then, but also super white centric.
Yeah. Well, this
to the extent where people on the panel wouldn't have certain black comedians on, like they said, yes, but they just talked about being black.
Well, this is why I couldn't give a shit about these awards, is because there are too many agendas behind a lot of them, and there are too many reasonings for putting people forward that aren't necessarily that they were funny.
Yeah.
So,
yes.
As a result, I'm like...
Was it Copstick who said, like, yes, but he was just funny? She's yeah. Like, yeah, that's the point.
Yeah. She had to...
It's got to be more than funny.
When it was McIntyre, she had to push him through. Because
he didn't make it in the end.
Her and Bruce really pushed at him, but he didn't win it or something. Yeah.
No, he didn't make the shortlist. That was the year I. Oh no! The year before, he and I were very, very close. Both of us were shortlisted, and then we didn't make the final nominations.
Yeah.
And everyone claims that, but I know it to be true because both Michael and I were on the West End run.
Right.
And I had to follow him.
Well, here's the thing.
So anyone that says he's shit, try and follow him.
Well, here's the thing. If someone wanted to nominate my show, I'm not going to go, can you not do that? Because I'm not a moron. But it just doesn't, like you said, it's changed as a thing.
It doesn't mean what it used to, for sure.
Yeah. I'm going to end it just by asking you a regular question I'd ask at the end. Like, yep. Normally I have quick fire questions, but to be honest with you, this one's got such a different vibe to it that...
You're worried about my cat fucking your shit up. He will as well.
Do you know why?
Come here.
Do you know why? Because if he ruins...
He wants a lap.
If he hits delete, or if he like pulls a cable...
And he's a fucking bag of chaos. Look at him. He's got three legs.
Oh, he's lovely, though.
Oh, he's awesome. I love him. Oh. And not only that, I didn't buy a cat.
What did you buy?
No, he turned up.
Oh, wow.
It's my...
So he just lives with you now?
Yeah, my brother and sister-in-law like got their kids a bunch of pets. The kitten obviously went, wait a minute, I can get terrorized by like a 5 and 3-year-old, whatever they were at the time, or there's an Aussie bloke just across the way who lights fires until May. And so that was a no-brainer. So he moved in. So I love him because he chose us. And then when he got the nerve damage and we had to amputate his leg, oh, broke my heart. It was rough. It's one of the best decisions we've ever made. Is we thought, we can't look after a three-legged cat. We'll have to put him down. I'm so glad I paid for him to have an amputation. And he's still alive. It's one of the best decisions I've ever made. He's a good guy.
He seems like a lovely one.
Yeah. On TripAdvisor, because people can rent yurts on the property. Because
yeah.
All this whole area, this is my father-in-law's.
Oh, okay.
So it's all my wife's family around here. Hmm. So the brother and sister-in-law run the farm shop. Then my father-in-law's across the way. And then that's us in here. And there's people rent yurts on the property. And all the reviews on TripAdvisor are about the cat.
So cute.
About skedaddle.
That's really cute.
It isn't it? That doesn't answer. What's your question?
My last question was going to be, if you had one bit of advice for someone who wanted to start their own fan base, like as in they're maybe moving up or they're starting to do shows and they want to like stay in contact with their fans or they want to build some sort of connection with them, what would you say?
Interestingly, I got to do DIY very early and I got a lot of shit for it at the time, I remember, but I thought I write a lot and people that did give me shit about it didn't write that much. They dined out on their same 20 minutes on the club circuit. I thought I'm running between 2 to 3 hours a year. Like I got the Edinburgh hour that I honed, but I discard an hour in the process. So why am I writing all this stuff without recording it? So I made CDs and I would sell them at shows. I think now it's like everything is on flash drives. So the number one thing is get the Zoom recorder.
Learn how to use it.
Learn to edit. You know, it's actually very easy to teach yourself everything these days online. Record everything. Yeah, just, I think, record everything. And maybe, a mistake I made, do 5 episodes first before you put anything out. if you're making like a podcast, because the first 5 are fucking unlistenable.
Yeah, I'd agree with that.
Yeah, it's terrible, aren't they? It's terrible.
Go back and listen to episode 6.
Yeah, and don't be afraid to treat it like a set. Don't be afraid to, because stream of consciousness isn't as interesting as you think it is. If you're not interviewing someone and it's just you're doing an intro yourself, you come up with just stuff that you want to talk about. Like, don't be afraid to have a notebook and treat it like a joke book, because otherwise it'll just be meandering babble, much like I've done on this. It's been hard to stay on track sometimes of like, why is he talking about that now?
It's gonna be a tough edit.
It's gonna be a tough edit for sure. I know. I even knew while I was doing it, I thought, oh, this is an unfair segue.
So well, thank you very much for coming on.
Thank you. Thanks for driving all the way out here.
That was Brendan. I adored getting into the nitty-gritty of what drives a comedian and the subtext within jokes and the ownership conversation. I loved listening back to that. That was one of my favourite things that I've had a discussion with someone in a while. So I hope you enjoyed it as much as I did, and I hope you got a lot out of it. If you are new here, please do consider subscribing. If you're old here, please do consider giving us an honest review on iTunes. Ideally 5 stars. A lot of work does go into this, and it does maintain the thing that you like, if you like it. Or you can donate actual cash money on the website, which is simonkane.co.uk. If you do decide to donate money, if you want to donate more than a fiver for this podcast in any way, do consider buying a copy of my book. It's called How to Make a Living by Working for Free, and it's about making a community around online content that you make online. So if you wanted to give more than £5 and you also want something back that could maybe help you create your own community online, which is what Brendan and I talked about in the podcast in terms of building an audience for what you do, then that could be something you might be interested in. So feel free to buy it. £5 for a digital version, and I think it's about £10 or £11 for the paperback, including posters and packaging. Check the website, simonkane.co.uk/shop. As I mentioned before, Brendan and myself are both doing the Edinburgh Fringe Festival 2017. So here's a quick plug for both of our shows. If you want to come down as a result of this podcast or just general online content that either of us have given away, please do. I personally love meeting people from the podcast, and I know Brendan does as well. So here goes. Brendan is doing a show at the Gilded Balloon called Race Off at 6:45. He's also doing a split show with Colt Cabana, and where they commentate on wrestling matches at Monkey Barrel Comedy Club at 10:20 p.m. every day for the entire run. I am doing a show called Laughter is the Best Placebo. It is at Sweets Venue in the Grass Market at 5 p.m. every day. You can buy a ticket in advance to ensure you get a seat, or you can pay what you want on exit. I'm doing it every single day except Wednesdays, when I get rudely awoken by the dustman. You have no idea how much fun I'm having saying that to every journalist who says, "Oh, when are you on?" "Oh, yeah, I'm on every day except Wednesdays, when I get rudely awoken by the dustman." I promise it's funnier than that, but you wouldn't believe how hard it is to make admin amusing for yourself when you're trying to put together a show. So, yeah, please do come on any day except Wednesday. And also, me and Brendan have discussed it a bit in this episode, but we're going to do another follow-up episode, which will be about mental health and about his process of trying to control his mental health while at the Edinburgh Festival, and bits beyond that as well, which we've sort of discussed off mic and between ourselves. So I hope you enjoy that, and hopefully that'll be out early next year, because I kind of want there to be a bit of a space between the two. So yeah, that's really exciting, and I'm really looking forward to that. Hope to see you all at the festival, and hope you enjoyed this episode. Thank you very much for listening. Thank you very much for subscribing. Thank you very much for donating or coming down and watching my show at the festival if you do. See you all in about 15 days' time. Bye!
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.